We have the winds of our own totalitarian society freezing the land solid, a tortured tundra.
What we must have is a new American dream. We are allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. A new American dream, not of homes and toasters, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. The new America, the real hope of the world.
Some of those who have spoken the truth are no longer here. Their chairs at the Thanksgiving adult big table are empty. Their relatives have sent them to Siberia with a roll of their eye. So let us begin. Here we go. Scooch up to the samovar. Maybe leave your hat and boots on. Fill your peasant hands with a warm drink and listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
Is it a boy or is it a girl? It takes all kinds to make our world go round. The army life ought to be a stipulation. That's the proper education. 25 years probation. And give them a double helping of the rules and regulations. The rules and regulations. The rules and regulations. Now live your own life, I tell you for why. You're gonna be around when they all die off. The future life ought to be a weight off your shoulders. You'll feel a little bit bolder. And in the photograph folder, there'll be faded pictures of the rules and regulations. The rules and regulations. I never have cared much for rules and regulations. Those verses came from 60s folk singer and songwriter Donovan Leitch. They sum things up pretty nicely. Our government doesn't care for rules either. But they're supposed to be our government. Now they really need some rules. They're supposed to be there for us. Instead, they do everything for them. And they do their best to keep us dumb, fat, and ignorant. And docile. And afraid. On this show, we refuse to be afraid, or at least we refuse to allow our fears to govern what we do. We stream here every Thursday on the New American Dream radio show because we believe in freedom. We believe in peace. We believe that we, the people of the United States of America, are the true power in our country. And we're raising our voices to tell you about it. So join us right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com every week. Remember, it's listener supported. You stop by there. It helps them out, helps us out. Mention our name. Anyway, without further ado, I'm now going to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Chuck, tonight we welcome special guests Sherwood Ross, Holy Damagard, and Mickey Z. And so tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Coral Gables, somewhere in Spain, New York City, and wherever you are. Do you read papers, watch TV, listen to mainstream radio? How many years was it until you realized there is nothing for you there? In the spirit of Vladimir Voinovich, Catch-22, Ray Bradbury, Fahrenheit 451, we, Chuck Gregory and I, CWG Press, offer Camp America, AGB, Best-Seven Nation, Speak English, Looking for Bigfoot, Iowa Terror, One Last Liberal Outlaw, Sweat, Global Warming in a Small Town, White Picket Fences, Homeland Security in a Small Town, and soon more, all as affordable ebooks. There will soon be a revolutionary moment when Americans will come to understand and fight back. They're now being choked by no outlets of expression or learning in the mass media, mass culture. Americans will soon be forced to embrace Samizdat and value the most important parts of our culture. You just got to believe that the Dark Ages days of O'Reilly and Cooper and Couric, rather, Brokaw, Goodman, Stewart, Maddow, Marr, well, it's just got to end someday. The revolution begins with words, with ideas, and the passing along of those ideas. The Clinton, Bush, Obama troika is not long for this world. There will come an enlightenment, a renaissance, which will begin with words. People will see the truth, and we will live. Besides these e-books, we are also presenting a truth trilogy. The first of that was the dynamic duo, a biography of Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett. It's completed and available. And in process is a book cataloging and explaining the rash of United States false flags, false terror events in recent years, and then finally, there will be a book that will explore the questions of whether we went to the moon and whether the Holocaust happened as we are being told, all produced by Chuck Gregory and CWG Press. So if you're bored, discouraged, feel like giving up, well, turn off the TV, take a look at these books, and see if reading is something you might like to get back to. And stay tuned. Okay, now, June 5th today, the 46th anniversary of the shooting of Robert F. Kennedy at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. I remember that time. It was bad, bad. 1968, junior high. So big of expectations for life and for the world, and then shot down. We thought lone assassins were doing it. We were wrong. It was planned. And the incredible thing is, and you can believe this or not, is that that day is still connected to this day, a thread. Still happening by the same people, their associates, and to an even greater degree. And we still don't accept the real story. We cling to the NBC Nightly News version of American history, and it is destroying us, if it hasn't already. Go here. Black Op Radio Archives, the last two shows, William Pepper and Lisa Pease. And you will know more than if you spend 24 hours watching anything you'll ever find on television or in the so-called alternative media. And that is the truth. That is our world.
On June 4, 1968, popular Democratic Party presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy waited all day for the election results to come in from the Democratic primary in California. At 11:30 p.m., Kennedy, his wife Ethel, and the rest of his entourage left the royal suite of the Ambassador Hotel and headed downstairs to the ballroom, where approximately 1,800 supporters waited for him to give his victory speech. After giving his speech and ending with, "Now, on to Chicago and let's win there," Kennedy turned and exited the ballroom to a side door that led to a kitchen pantry. Kennedy was using this pantry as a shortcut to reach the colonial room where the press were waiting for him. As Kennedy traveled down this pantry corridor, which is filled with people trying to catch a glimpse of the potential future president, 24-year-old Palestinian-born Sirhan stepped up to Robert Kennedy and opened fire with his .22 pistol. While Sirhan was still firing, bodyguards and others tried to contain the gunman. However, Sirhan managed to fire all 8 bullets before being subdued. 6 people were hit. Robert Kennedy fell to the floor bleeding. As he lay bleeding, Ethel rushed to his side and cradled his head. Busboy Juan Romero brought over some rosary beads and placed them in Kennedy's hand. Kennedy, who had been seriously hurt and looked in pain, whispered, "Is everybody all right?" Dr. Stanley Abbo quickly examined Kennedy at the scene and discovered a hole just below his right ear. Now, what this, the popular culture account of the murder, does not mention is that Sirhan was always in front of Kennedy. No way could he have fired behind his right ear. From Oswald to James Earl Ray to Sirhan to Oklahoma City, 9/11, the Aurora, Colorado Theater, Tucson, Sandy Hook, Boston. So strange but true. We're being led by lies, by the powerful and deceptive and apparently psychotic. The Twilight Zone. The American dream is actually the nightmare, and we are still asleep. too many bullet holes and bullet sounds in the pantry. Scott Enyart's photos taken away forever. Susan Serrano harassed. Serrano, for more than an hour, insists that she saw and heard what she described immediately after the shooting. Agent Hank Hernandez repeats over and over that she is shaming Kennedy, that she isn't letting the family have any peace, that she didn't see what she said she saw and didn't hear what she said she heard. After an hour, Serrano, exhausted, begs him to stop, but he refuses, finally telling her there's only one way to stop this, by recanting. We're listening to systematic, purposeful torture. Hernandez is, it turns out, an expert at it. Finally, she breaks, weeping, desperate for the assault to end. Serrano was a serious problem for the police because she had a vivid encounter with the two people other than Sirhan, who directly involved in the shooting, and because her contemporaneous account to television viewers immediately after was so articulate and sincere. While there were actually dozens of witnesses who saw Sirhan in the company of the infamous girl in the polka dot dress and a tall Caucasian male, the general public knew only of Serrano. And if her story could not be shaken, it would be difficult to convince people that Sirhan has really acted alone. When Serrano insists on what she saw and heard, Hernandez berates her. You'll live a life of shame knowing what you're doing right now is wrong. What you say is not true. Tell me why you made up this story. Gamely, Serrano refuses to change her statement. It happened, she insists. No, it didn't happen, he says. Nobody told you we shot him. I'm sorry, but that's true. That is true, Serrano replies. Hernandez will not ease off. For more than an hour, he hammers her. If you love the man, he says, least you owe him is letting him rest in peace. He casts himself as the protector of the candidate and his family. An obscenity, since it's clear from his own life and history that Hernandez hated Kennedy. He promises Serrano that if she will only recant, she'll get a letter from Ethel Kennedy thanking her. Finally, as Serrano begins to crumble, Hernandez escalates. Why are you making yourself suffer like this? He tells her that stress is bad for your heart. This is going to make an old woman of you. He promises her if she changes her story, he can protect her from further interrogation. Tell me why you made up this story and no one else will talk to you, he says. The other way is for me to go out there and tell these people that you failed the polygraph test. Serrano pleads with him to stop, but there is only one way that will happen. Finally, exhausted and weeping, Serrano agrees that she no longer knows what happened, that she's confused. Hernandez gets it on paper and files a report which states, Miss Serrano admitted that the story about Sirhan and the girl in the polka dot dress was not true. Years later, and to this day, Serrano is clear about what she saw and heard and bitter about her treatment by the LAPD. They wanted her to lie, she said, and they weren't going to let her out of that room until she did. The killing of Robert F. Kennedy, the senator who would surely have been president had he not been gunned down, is at the same time an ostensibly simpler yet more mysterious crime than the assassination of his brother, the president. How many possible keys to the JFK assassination lie in documents, events, and witness testimony, much of it accrued by two separate government commissions? The interlocking intelligence, military, and underworld operations that seem somehow to bear on the Dallas events speak more or less for themselves. Lee Harvey Oswald may have taken the final secret of JFK to his premature grave, but he left a paper trail behind him. The secrets of Robert Kennedy's assassination lie locked in the most secure vault of all, a man's mind. Sirhan Bashir Sirhan, who still sits in jail today, his sentence commuted from death to life, has never been able to remember what happened the night of June 5, 1968, when he lunged out of a crowd and opened a wildfire in Kennedy's general direction. Unlike the politically preoccupied Oswald, Sirhan never had any strong political conviction. And unlike Oswald, the globe-trotting Marine, whose biography is a cryptogram of curious connections, Sirhan's life leading up to the assassination is remarkable only for its unremarkability. No satisfactory motive for his action has ever been revealed, because even he does not know why he shot Kennedy, or even if he did. 5 months later, Richard Nixon, who 8 years beforehand had lost the narrowest election in U.S. history to Kennedy's older brother, defeated Kennedy's replacement on the Democratic ticket, Humphrey, by the second smallest margin. The Los Angeles Police Department, at the time the most respected municipal law enforcement agency in the country, thanks to its spiffy dragnet image, took over the investigation, forming a task force dubbed Special Unit Senator. Determined not to repeat the mistakes of Dallas, the LAPD formulated an impenetrable case against the lone assassin, who was subsequently easily convicted. The blood seeping from Kennedy's head came from a wound behind his right ear. Powder burns indicated that the shot came from no further than 2 or 3 inches away. Sirhan was at all times in front of Kennedy. Sirhan never got closer than a few feet. Given that single piece of evidence, there's no physical possibility that Sirhan could be the lone assassin. The coroner who has ascertained the position of the fatal wound, Thomas Noguchi, was fired and had to sue to get his job back. Based on evidence of bullet holes and bullets found in the pantry, at least 13 shots were fired. Sirhan's pistol held just 8 shots, and they were accounted for, having been recovered from Kennedy's body and the bodies of other wounded victims. The LAPD explained some of the extra bullet holes as dents caused by food cartons, and suppressed photographs of its own officers examining other holes. Ceiling panels and door jams where extra bullet holes were sighted and photographed were destroyed. At least 5 witnesses, according to police reports, saw a woman in a polka dot dress fleeing the scene of the assassination. Some of the witnesses, notably a young Kennedy campaign worker named Sandra Serrano, heard the woman shouting gleefully, "We shot him!" Serrano asked the mystery woman whom they shot. Senator Kennedy, the woman replied on her hurried way out.
Our first guest of the night is Mickey Z. Mickey Zezima is a New York City writer, and we will hear a recording of Mickey speaking at a rally in Union Square Park on May 24th, a rally against Monsanto. Mickey is a writer. He has a website, and you can find him all over the internet.
Hello, everyone. I had the task, according to Michael, of connecting everything in 8 minutes, so I did bring some notes. Let me begin, as always, by saying peace and power to all species. Look at all these earthlings here. What would it sound like if all these earthlings at the same time screamed, "Fuck Monsanto"? It could be louder than that. 1, 2, 3. That's what I'm talking about. All right. Let's give a round of applause to the organizers for doing an amazing job. And I want to personally thank them for giving me the opportunity to speak here in historic Union Square Park, where over 100 years ago, standing right here, was a woman by the name of Emma Goldman. Can I get a raised fist for Emma Goldman? All right. All right. Now, I'm sure there are many reasons why people came out here today. Perhaps they wanted to acknowledge that GMOs are not labeled. They're not tested by the FDA. That GMOs, once released into the environment, cannot be recalled. GMOs are not designed to feed the poor, and so on and so on. Whatever the reason was that brought you out to the park today, I want to connect it with one simple fact. The mess that we're in, this mess, Monsanto, GMOs, the corporate culture, the destruction of the ecosystem, is not the result of some preordained theology or some unstoppable force of nature. We are in this mess because of human decisions. If different decisions had been made in the past, different outcomes would have likely occurred. If new decisions are made right now, perhaps some new outcomes can occur. So we got to make some new decisions. And the idea is to put into practice the kind of world that we want to live in. And as it relates to GMOs, the first and easiest thing to do is avoid them. Don't buy them. Don't consume them. Yeah. Also, go into the stores and label them yourself. If they won't label them, we'll label them. And we can connect on a local level with community-supported agriculture, community gardens, seed banks, seed bomb events, and so on. But perhaps the most fundamental thing we can do is to take back the right to grow our own food. And we can do this on window boxes, fire escapes, rooftops, backyards, and if you have one, lawns. Imagine if every lawn was instead a vegetable garden. The most irrigated crop in America is lawn. 40 million acres from sea to overfished sea. And it takes about 10 times as many chemicals to treat lawn than it does per acre than it does to treat industrial farmland. This is how the corporate culture and companies like Monsanto have twisted us into surrendering our ability to grow our own food and instead willingly poisoning our own landscape. Now, since I mentioned industrial farmland, let me ask the question. How many vegans do we have here today? Make some noise if you're a vegan. Get out if you're a vegan. That's not bad for a bunch of protein-deficient, annoying, self-righteous militants. I'm impressed. Hello, Kenny. Well, here's the reality. Roughly 95% of, depending on the grain, of grains grown in America are genetically modified. The vast majority of those grains aren't fed to humans. They're fed to doomed animals, which are then murdered for so-called food to be fed back to humans. And guess what? That food is also not labeled genetically modified. Hey, Stacy. What it comes down to is that food justice means a lot more than just screaming, fuck Monsanto. So here's another new idea. In the name of eco-defense, let's embrace holistic justice, collective liberation, and move towards a plant-based lifestyle. Because GMOs are not the only hidden ingredient in animal food. For those of you who are not vegans, let me tell you what else is not on that label. There's unspeakable animal cruelty. There is a human hell holocaust. There is exploited human labor. There is more power and more control for the 1%. There is the hierarchy of privilege. And perhaps most relevant to today, there is irreversible environmental devastation. So if your idea after the march is a good idea to go get a burger or order a pizza, just remember that industry, the global animal agribusiness, eats up and destroys one-third of the planet's land surface. It is directly responsible for topsoil depletion, deforestation, species extinction, and so on, overfishing and so on. And it is the number one source of human-created greenhouse gases, which translates directly into climate change. So if you call yourself an environmentalist, if you call yourself an activist, here's a new decision for you. Start living it 24 hours a day. Embrace food justice 24 hours a day. What it comes down to is that nothing matters unless we have a functioning ecosystem. Whatever your personal issue is, go for it. We need as many activists as possible. But none of it matters unless the ecosystem is functioning. And that's where we can unite. We must make these big connections. We can't just focus on one corporation. We could look at the other corporations that are killing the ecosystem via the food industry. There are far too many to name, but there could be Cargill, Tyson, Smithfield, KFC, Nestle's, McDonald's, and so on. So we must bring down Monsanto, but we can't forget all the other corporations. And this is where our food choices and our commitment to food justice connects directly to Wall Street. And it has the support of both political parties, and it makes possible so-called free trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, aka TPP. And if that passes as it stands right now, it means that more third world countries will be forced to shift to factory farming in order to remain competitive. So that translates into game over for the environment. So the idea, as you see what I'm doing here, is to make connections. Connections between the big issues and connections with each other. Do not leave this march today without making some new connections. Preferably some people that might not agree with you on everything. And then use these new connections to create more actions. One day isn't enough. We need this. We need to make a habit of this. So we need to embrace activism as a lifestyle. And I know... And I know that choosing sustained activism or direct action can be a frightening or a scary choice. But ask yourself this, is there anything more frightening and more scary than surrendering control of your food and your water? So do not opt for the illusion of safety over the quest for justice. There are good reasons to be afraid, comrades, but there are better reasons to be bold. So as simple as this, in this struggle that we're in, it's real simple. Either you're working to preserve the future or you're not. So ask yourself, which side am I on? Because we need a planet with far fewer reasons to grieve and far more reasons to celebrate. And the good news is that there is a growing celebration meeting right here at the corner of empathy and anger. And what we're planning is nothing short of a global jailbreak. And remember these words, ask not what your ecosystem can do for you, ask what you can do for your ecosystem. Peace and power to all creatures. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that was a great speech from Mickey Z. And what he said about activism and making connections is so true. Remember, we all have a lot in common. Even when we disagree in major ways, there are other things that we have in common. And all of us can work together to make change.
And now for another episode of Waterboarding Henry Kissinger, sponsored by Mr. Bubble. If we're going to torture people who we say we think are terrorists, but we know are not really terrorists because we did 9/11, there are no terrorists, no Al-Qaeda, no reason for war, and really no information we can gain other than to perpetuate the lie, go deeper into the story of the lie, build and embellish the lie fable, then why not also waterboard people who we know are terrorists, who are in fact our terrorists, who helped us to lie a long time ago and overturn our country, and this terrorist really knows the truth, and what he knows is actually real. One or two or maybe three quick sessions, which are not really such a big deal anyway, right, would change the course of this whole country. Just one little goon afternoon, live on national TV on the Upper West Side, maybe Central Park on a nice summer morning, skateboarders, joggers, mothers pushing strollers. It could be a beautiful American experience, something for Ken Burns. The committee to waterboard Henry Kissinger, who worked to overthrow the elected administration of Chile President Salvador Allende because his administration was not marching to the beat of Washington's drum, killing thousands of people, subverting democracy, not giving a damn, being praised in America and continuing to live in America free, not in Leavenworth or Attica or Lewisburg, and that's a crime in itself. I know, right? We are the committee to waterboard Henry Kissinger. It's not really that bad anyway. endorsed by Alan Dulles, Dick Cheney, George Bush Jr., George Bush Sr., John Yoo, Barack Obama, 2 dental assistants, 4 Walmart produce managers, and millions of folks like you. Sponsored by Mr. Bubble. Get you so clean your mother won't know you. The committee to waterboard Henry Kissinger is also affiliated with and endorsed by the committee to waterboard Fane Eugene Caesar in Simi Valley, ASAP.
And now for Hollywood Squares with Gene Rosen, H. Wayne Carver, Carlos Arredondo, Robbie Parker, the Harley Guy, with your host, Anderson Cooper. Find out who is the secret square. Tic-tac-toe, X's, O's, answers and blocks, celebrity actors, Hollywood Squares with Gene Rosen, H. Wayne Carver, Carlos Arredondo, Robbie Parker, the Holler Guy. Produced and directed by Danny Thomas, CBS, and the NSA.
SEALs, Rangers, Green Berets, the best this country has to offer. Right at the front of any parade, on TV, on the ball field, holding the flag, singing the anthem. What do the brightest, the strongest, the best that America has, what do? Repair sidewalks and schools and homes in poor neighborhoods? Tell children the truth about their history? No. They swim underwater, rappel, parachute, and then kill. They kill people they have been told are our enemies. They break their skulls, slice their throats, stomp their faces, stab their hearts, shoot and explode their heads. The best America has to offer. Overheard in the back room of the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines recruiting depot on 9th Street, and also at the mall, also at Walmart. You know, you put on these clothes, it's very slimming. In fact, you disappear. I can't see you. The American Camel Culture, brought to you by Men's Warehouse. You'd look better wearing nothing at all. I guarantee it. With so many folks wearing camel these days on Major League Baseball fields and restaurants at the mall, these create gaps in reality, pernicious portals to Portland, perhaps. We can't see you. We can't see this space, this sitting space, this moving space of camouflage and blankness, nothingness. There are holes in our culture, in our world, blank spaces everywhere. Things don't fit, match up. Something is missing. The American Camel Culture, brought to you by Men's Warehouse. You'd look better wearing nothing at all. I guarantee it.
And now for another episode of the Jolly Bama. Nobel Peace Prize winner, His Holiness. He sits on his throne just on the other side of the front fence on the White House lawn in his red robes, his head shaven, smoking a cigarette. Can't touch him. Can't talk to him. He smiles, waves his hands. People bow. Others die. While throngs walk on their knees for miles through thick dandelions just to see him. He gives his pronouncements. I believe in American exceptionalism with every fiber of my being. But what makes us exceptional is not our ability to flout international norms and the rule of law. It is our willingness to affirm them through our actions. Actions indeed. In the 21st century, American exceptionalism has destroyed 7 countries in whole or in part. Millions of people are dead, maimed, and displaced. And all of this criminal destruction is evidence of Washington's reaffirmation of international norms and the rule of law. Destruction and murder are merely collateral damage from Washington's affirmation of international norms. American exceptionalism also means that U.S. presidents can lie through their teeth and misrepresent those they choose to demonize. He's the Dalai Lama, peace hero of hope and change, executioner, decision maker, jokester. Sponsored by, well, you can only imagine.
Yep, I'm pretty sure it's this Saturday. Check the shopper. Yeah, right there. There it is. I thought so. Yeah, it's the Rotary, Sertoma, JCs, Kiwanis, Lions, Tigers, Legion, and the Moose Club. these sons of Moose, whose grandfathers and fathers have been saving Kennedy half dollars since 1964, and who knew this day would come, when Kennedy half dollars would be worth 54 cents. Selling them this Saturday in the park, I think it might be the 4th of July, to commemorate the killing of Jack Kennedy, which brought about the wealth of so many people because they could do whatever they want, steal from almost everyone, get rich, buy a boat, mow their lawns, caulk their windows, caulk their swimming pools and their patios, caulk everything not moving. Stop in for Freedom Fizz and Liberty Cakes and get yourself some American Nazi memorabilia that you will be able to sell in 2020 for 57 cents. It's the American way. Well, our next guest of the evening is Sherwood Ross, and we are early. Sherwood Ross is a longtime journalist. He started out in Chicago. He worked for the civil rights movement. He worked for the Chicago News Service quite a few years ago, but he's been working ever since to tell us he's a true journalist. He's been working ever since to tell us the truth about America, and we're glad that he takes the time to do that for us or with us every month. And Chuck will try and get Sherwood on the Ross on the phone, even though we're 5 minutes early.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system. 30 5205.
Well, Chuck, I guess he's gonna be home at quarter till. That's what we.
I told him quarter till.
You said you were taking. You want to chat for about 5 minutes and call again?
Sure. Sounds fine.
You mind if I ask you about the movie class you're taking? Is that
no? It's over now, but. It was a fascinating class. There are a lot of great classes available over the internet from an assortment, a large assortment of different universities. The one that Lorraine and I took was offered by Wesleyan University, where I went to school. And it was a course it was called Marriage in the Movies, taught by Janine Basinger, who was actually teaching when I went to school there at Wesleyan back in the early 70s. Janine is very knowledgeable and gave great lectures and taught us. It was a combination of history and a survey of different themes. She identified seven themes that Hollywood has used, and an old question of, you know, why is the marriage movie not considered an actual genre? It was really quite a fascinating course.
Do you remember some of the movies you got to watch as part of the course?
Mm-hmm. a lot of them.
Yeah, but do I remember the name? Let's see. You would ask that, wouldn't you? Hang on a second.
South Pacific.
Some of the movies were Brief Encounter, Vivacious Lady, Dodsworth, Suspicion. Now, you might not think of Suspicion, which is a Hitchcock movie, as being a marriage movie, but it really is. One of the seven themes she identified, it wasn't all about, the problems weren't simple ones always, like money or situation. Sometimes the problems got really crazy, like murder, and that's what Suspicion is all about. There was a test at the end, and actually I had to take the test at the end because I was the one that signed up for it. Lorraine was able to attend everything, and then she didn't get to join me in the test because I had to sign this, you know, honor system thing that the answers were all completely mine, and so I had to do the whole test myself.
Oh.
But I Go ahead.
Were the movies ones you had heard of before, or were they new movies, different?
They were ones that we had heard of before. I think we probably, at least one of us had seen maybe three out of the dozen movies that we watched for the course. So there, a lot of them were new to us, although certainly I'd heard of almost all of them.
I know you guys, watching movies is a big thing for you guys. So this class was right up your alley then, huh?
It sure was. And it was kind of a chance for me to share a little something of my from my college times with my wife, and that was really cool.
And Wesleyan College is where?
Wesleyan University is in Middletown, Connecticut.
Middletown, Connecticut. Where's, yep. And that's
halfway where, between Hartford and New Haven, or halfway between New York and Boston.
You know, I did go through there once on a trip. I was driving, and to me, it seems like everything's really tight. Is that right?
Well,
that
yeah,
right
all of New England is really tight. Yeah, it's very.
I mean, it
seems
like it's all compressed, isn't it? Like,
yep, it sure is. It sure is. Okay, let's give Sherwood a try.
Again, this is Sherwood Ross, and he's speaking to us from Coral Gables. Hello.
Well, hello, Sherwood. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Are we ready to go on now?
You're on the air right now.
Well, that's great, Chuck. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this new book, just published after 13 years of research by a high officer in the United States Navy, James Norvell. He charges President Lyndon Johnson and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover were behind the murder of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. I want to tell you up front that I am a publicist for the book and proud of it. I was also a personal friend of Dr. King. I walked across much of Mississippi with him in 1966. And so I am especially concerned that his actual killers are exposed and that any shooters still living are brought to justice. That's why I'm urging you to buy this book. It's called Treason, Treachery, and Deceit. The murderers of JFK, MLK, and RFK. And the idea behind it that Norvell brings to the front is that J. Edgar Hoover hated Reverend King because he thought he was a hypocrite, unfaithful to his wife, and a potentially subversive communist. And he had opposed the Vietnam War. As for President Johnson, Norvell says Johnson thought King would start a revolt against the American economic system, which I can tell you, having been around them, this is total hogwash. Arthur Norvell, who died in Fort Worth, Texas last December, when he left the Navy, he practiced law for 30 years, some of them as an attorney for Billy Sol Estes, who was a close aide and confidant of President Johnson. Well, we get to our story. Reverend King was shot dead April 4th, 1968, in Memphis, Tennessee. James Earl Ray, an escaped convict, was convicted about a year later. Ray pled guilty in order to avoid a trial. The trial would have exposed the fact that he was innocent. Arthur Norvell says Ray never shot King, but that he was allowed to escape from prison and brought to Memphis, Tennessee, to take the rap for the actual killers, which he did. Norvell said Hoover and Texas oil magnate H.L. Hunt argued over how to put an end to King's crusades. Hunt initially thought, and this is preposterous, some thought that his own radio broadcast would silence Reverend King. But Hoover thought they needed a permanent solution, and after King's murder, Hunt told his security assistant, Hoover won that argument. James Earl Ray was another innocent patsy, Norvell writes, much like Lee Harvey Oswald, who 3 years earlier was called the killer of President John F. Kennedy, much like Sirhan Sirhan, who is the alleged killer of Senator Robert F. Kennedy, but in fact the job was done by somebody else. Norvell says each attorney for these three patsies was interested more in his own pocketbook than in defending Ray or Sirhan Sirhan or Oswald. Ray's prison escape from Jefferson City, Missouri was engineered, Norvell says, so that he could be the fall guy for the murder, because Ray was probably looking at life imprisonment anyway if captured, and wouldn't mind if his guilty plea for Reverend King's murder got him another 99 years. In addition to conspirators J. Edgar Hoover, H.L. Hunt, President Johnson, Norvell identifies two shooters of Reverend King in his book, Lloyd Jowers and a mysterious U.S. intelligence agency operative known as Raoul. Jowers is manager of Jim's Bar and Grill opposite the Lorraine Hotel, which was the site of King's murder in Memphis, and where they now have the U.S. Civil Rights Museum, which is worth a visit. If you have an opportunity to go there, do it. According to author Norvell, Raoul was Ray's handler and gave him assignments, such as the purchase of a deer rifle, and he moved Ray around to several cities. Ray was a poor shot and not used in the assassination, except to be set up as a patsy. On the day of the murder, Reverend King's chauffeur, Solomon Jones, was waiting downstairs in the parking lot of the Lorraine Hotel in Memphis when he saw two white men listening to Reverend King's conversation with his aides up on the second floor balcony. When the fatal shot was fired, Jones cried out, "There they are, right there." Norvell said neither of the shooters was Ray. He also notes that the black police officers and firemen were pulled off the job shortly before the slaying, indicating a conspiracy in which the authorities were involved. So this is the book, Treason, Treachery, and Deceit, The Murders of JFK, MLK, and RFK by James Norvell. And you can order it through Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, eBooks, and Nook Books, among others. The book has been acclaimed and endorsed, including by military writers. Brigadier General John Grubbs, a PhD, refers to it as a spellbinding masterpiece. Douglas Horn, who is the former chief analyst for military records of the Assassination Records Review Board, he writes, "Mr. Norvell does not pull any punches and does not sugarcoat the assassination in any way." And Bob McClellan, who wrote the book, How LBJ Killed JFK, praises Norvell for bringing us nearer to the solution to the most horrific crimes in American history, horrific for what they did to these men and their families, horrific for what it did to America, and horrific for the failure of the authorities to mete out justice. You know, the murder of Dr. King changed America. It killed the acknowledged leader of the civil rights movement and put an end to any possible political career King might have undertaken. You know, he was immensely popular in the 60s, and could have made a successful run for the White House. Anyway, he was a political threat. If he had been elected, that would have been the end of the Vietnam War. In a private conversation I had with Dr. King shortly before his murder, he left no doubt that he strongly opposed the war and was considering his options. He was the greatest American of his century, and the facts behind his assassination need to be brought to public attention. I'm Sherwood Ross. Good night to every one of you.
Sherwood, thank you so much. But before you leave, where were you, if you remember, at the time that that Robert Kennedy was shot, and also when Martin Luther King was shot? Do you remember those?
Sure. I was in my car with my parents. We were coming back from a vacation. And as we were driving across northern Indiana, we saw columns of smoke rising from Chicago. That's what I remember about the King assassination, that while I wasn't in Memphis, I was in Chicago, and a good part of the city was on fire. As for the assassination of Senator Kennedy, I do not remember exactly where I was, but it was probably in Washington, D.C., when I was distributing press releases in the National Press Building.
Well, you know, I was just trying to remember where I was for those two, and I just drew a blank. And thinking back on that, I mean, these were such important events. Why would I not remember? And I have a theory. I think that during the 60s, we actually became accustomed to famous people getting shot. We became complacent. We came to expect it. Hey, if we like somebody, they're probably going to be shot, and so we better not get too attached because they're going to be gone.
Well, the United States became what Americans derisively call, about our Latin cousins, Latin America, a banana republic, because some of the South American countries had reputations for violent overthrow of the government. Of course, some of those were sponsored by the CIA. But
of course, we didn't know that then. Well, there's the end of our half hour. Thank you so much for being with us again, Sherwood. We look
You're very
to
welcome.
And now some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, cell phone, telepathy, and telegraph. Here's something from Craig in Crookston. Nicolas Maduro, he's Venezuela's democratically elected president. It doesn't matter. Washington's dirty war continues. It's done so since Chavez's December 1998 election. He became president in February 1999. He served until his March 5th, 2013 death. He survived Washington's April 2002 coup attempt, a 64-day 2002-2003 general strike and oil management lockout, a failed August 2004 national recall referendum. He was Washington's main hemispheric enemy. It wanted him ousted. It wanted him dead. Obama killed him, most likely by poison or cancer-causing substances. Four major surgeries in 18 months couldn't save him. He knew he was marked for death. He said so numerous times. So did Maduro, saying he was poisoned by dark forces in order to hit at the Venezuelan people in Latin America. Washington targets all independent nations for regime change. It wants subservient pro-Western governments replacing them. It wants convenient stooges. It controls empowered. Predatory capitalist harshness replacing economic and social justice. Control of Venezuela's vast hydrocarbon resources, by far the world's largest, proved mostly light sweet reserves are around 300 billion barrels. The Department of Energy estimates heavy and extra heavy oil resources at up to 1.36 trillion barrels. It's a prize Washington covets. For over 15 years, U.S. administrations targeted Venezuela disruptively. Obama continues what his predecessors began.
And now we have a note on plaid parchment from Father Tessio in Nazareth. Last Sunday, Pope Francis stunned the world by stopping his motorcade next to Israel's apartheid wall. He got out, laid his head on the wall, and prayed. Visible behind him was graffiti reading, "Pope, we need someone to speak about justice. Free Palestine." And a comparison of Palestine to the Warsaw Ghetto. The iconic photo of the Pope's Palestinian prayer went viral around the world. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu was furious, but vowed not to get mad, but to get even. One wonders what sort of revenge Netanyahu is plotting. The Pope's gesture spoke louder than his mostly empty words. He was obviously praying for the apartheid wall to come down, but he cannot say such things directly. The Zionists have more than enough financial and media power and enough professional killers and dirty tricks experts to get even with any pope who speaks out against them too forcefully and directly. The Pope's historic prayer at the apartheid wall illustrates the rise of religion as a force for social justice. The new Pope, Francis, seemed blessed with a heartfelt concern for ordinary people. He appears genuinely pained by the suffering of the Palestinians under Israeli oppression, and he seems instinctively opposed to the heartless power of New World Order bankster capitalism. If the new religious movements for social justice unite and make common cause with everyone who supports justice, including those who consider themselves secular, who knows what the future might bring.
And now from Duke and Dubuque. When mass shootings take place in the United States, corporate news media can almost uniformly be counted on to act as stenographers to power. They dutifully report exactly what they're told by authorities with wholehearted trust and close to no due diligence. This appears to have been the case yet again in the May 23rd Isla Vista, California mass murder. The public has been propagandized with a familiar storyline that law enforcement authorities have peppered with lurid details, including a disturbing manifesto and YouTube soliloquy from a well-to-do yet alienated man who had trouble forging relationships. So he went on a wild shooting spree, then committed suicide. Like numerous other tragic events that cry out for heightened measures against gun ownership, such as the Tucson shooting, the Sikh temple bloodletting, the Aurora movie theater massacre, and the Newtown school shooting, initial eyewitness accounts of what took place differ markedly from what news media presented in subsequent reports. Those laid out in law enforcement press conferences just hours after the event. Otto von Bismarck famously remarked, "Never believe anything in politics until it has been officially denied." In a society where the Second Amendment and gun violence have been vigorously politicized by powerful reformists like billionaire Michael Bloomberg, Attorney General Eric Holder, and President Barack Obama, journalists might be well served by keeping this dictum in mind.
And here is a note from Denmark Dan. Every year, the world's most powerful people meet in secret. Their agenda? Total world domination. Big media observe a near total blackout. It sounds like dystopian science fiction. Or a conspiracy theorist's worst nightmare. The strangest part is that it's true. The 2011 destabilization of Syria, the 9/11/2008 Goldman Sachs-led controlled demolition of the world economy, and probably even the 9/11 false flag events were all plotted or okayed by the Bilderberg. Fortunately, the world is fighting back. The rise of the internet-based alternative media has shredded the secrecy surrounding the annual Bilderberg Conference, allowing the people a glimpse of what their masters have in store for them. And the nations resisting the Bilderbergers' world takeover attempt, led by Iran, Russia, and China, are gaining ground. That's why this year's Bilderberg Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark, which ended on June 1st, was an exercise in damage control.
Some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, cell phone, telepathy, and telegraph. And now for another episode of The American Stuck in Traffic. The American Stuck in Traffic is stuck in traffic on Interstate 35 headed south to Minneapolis from a weekend at the cabin near Two Harbors on a Sunday afternoon. It's bumper to bumper with boats and bicycles on bungee cords. The kids and the wife are asleep in the back of the black SUV. His phone is dead because he left his charger at home. All he has are 9 miles of red brake lights flickering on and off, on and off. The freckled kid in front of him flipping him the bird through the back window of a giant home on wheels, and his own thoughts. He has no choice but to think. He tries to stop it, tries to think of playing baseball in ninth grade, making that diving catch with Mary Lou watching, but it's no use. Oh, crap, here it comes. The American stuck in traffic just lets it come like a big poop in the weeds in the woods.
Here in the United States, we're often brought up and told we don't have propaganda, but we have a hard-charging investigative press. We have this educated, skeptical, even cynical citizenry. And if there were powerful interests trying to manage or manipulate public opinion, they would be exposed. Your reality, actually, is just the opposite. Academics who've spent their lifetimes looking at how propaganda works find that it's actually in Western democracies and open societies where you need the most sophisticated sorts of propaganda. And since World War I, thanks to people like Ivy Lee and Eddie Bernays, propaganda has become a business, this business of public relations. Throngs of Iraqis spontaneously attack a statue of Saddam Hussein, the face obscured with old glory. Later, the stars and stripes are replaced with red, white, and black, symbolizing the transference of power from the liberators to the liberated. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld describes the scene as breathtaking. BBC Radio calls them amazing. And they were, because the entire event was staged. Years after the operation, a U.S. Army report admitted that the toppling of the Saddam statue had been engineered by a psychological operations group. The document states, our TPT, tactical psyop, saw the statue as a target of opportunity. A week earlier, another psychological operation laid the groundwork for what followed. The script was for a female Rambo turned damsel in distress to be rescued by U.S. Armed Forces. In the situation that we're talking about here with Private Lynch, as you know, on about the 23rd of March, her 507th maintenance company was ambushed. A number of the members of that maintenance company were killed, a number were captured, and a number were unaccounted for, she being one of them. They waited 24 hours to get the cameras there, to set up the whole thing to make this big rescue. The SWAT team goes in to save her, and she becomes an instant celebrity overnight. That story happened on the same day that the tanks were rolling into Baghdad. The same day that we shelled the Palestine Hotel where the independent journalist was. The same day we blew up Al Jazeera's television station and killed one of their journalists. All we're getting on the front pages of the papers and in the news is the rescue of Jessica Lynch. So that was a PR substitute story. Toppling the Saddam statue, they got Tlaib's group, the Rendon group, they actually formed them. The CIA paid the Rendon group to form the Iraqi Congress as a countergroup to Saddam Hussein. They were based here in the U.S. Then they flew them over there and they shipped them into Iraq. They were the ones who were standing around the statue as a tank was used to pull it over. The Rendon group had been around. He worked for George W.'s father, and he worked for Clinton, too. His firm used to be a public relations press guy for Carter, and he created a PR firm that specialized in war. The head of the Rendon group, John Rendon, denies that he's a national security strategist or a military tactician. Rather, he states, "I'm a politician, a person who uses communication to meet public policy or corporate policy objectives. In fact, I'm an information warrior and a perception manager." Following the first Gulf War, Rendon was paid $23 million by the CIA to create anti-Saddam propaganda. Following 9/11, he was charged with public relations for the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. Rendon is far from alone. Public relations has mushroomed into a $200 billion a year industry, with PR flacks in the United States now outnumbering journalists. Propaganda has become the primary means by which the wealthy communicate with the rest of society. Whether selling a product, a political candidate, a law, or war, seldom do the powerful deliver messages to the public before consulting their colleagues in the public relations industry. You see a news show, you watch 60 Minutes, or a Fox program, whatever it is, you tend to give more credibility to what you're told is journalism. If an advertisement comes on, hopefully you tend to be more skeptical of that, because obviously somebody put an awful lot of money into crafting this slick TV ad, Mary. But what you probably never suspect is that that news story you just watched was also crafted by a company given to the TV station or network with the understanding that they would put their own logos on it, identify it as real journalism, and air it.
The American stuck in traffic saw the big motorhome ahead of him pulling away. He flipped the little kid the bird and hoped the little kid would grow up an orphan because his face was just one giant freckle and his parents traded him for a better kid, one that would be a St. Thomas Academy hockey star and make them proud and famous at church. And one day he would see the little freckled kid on Hennepin Avenue asleep in the gutter at 2 p.m. and he would smile. The red brake lights of a giant motorhome flashed. The American stuck in traffic coasted up right behind the giant motorhome. He looked up at the freckled butt smushed into the back window. He tried to think of apple pie at Applebee's and Eden Prairie summer nights with Garrison Keillor on the radio and something else in winter, but it was no use. This program has in part been brought to you by the Iowa Ministry of Fear. If you're not afraid, you're not trying. Look, out your window, goldfinches, used by terrorists. Bird feeders are common drop-off areas for terrorist stuff. Have you seen slow drivers in your neighborhood described? Disguised as old ladies in white, blue, or gray hair, slots down so low it looks like nobody is driving, Harris. Call Walmart before it's too late. Be afraid. Be very afraid. We are your Iowa Ministry of Fear. We're also sponsored by a grant from Warm and Fuzzy Smallpox Blankets of Muncie, Indiana. Made in the USA. Good old American know-how. Smallpox blankets, drone airplanes, anthrax, and nuclear weapons. Bombs, bullets, fighter planes, our products. Welcome to life in 21st century America, where our products are death, destruction, low-paying jobs, and the tossing overboard of the poor, sick, and elderly, all to support the war racket. Made in the USA, making America strong, keeping our neighborhood strong, and our churches strong, our car dealerships strong, and our country clubs strong. Warm and Fuzzy, Smallpox Blankets of Muncie. And just to end this late-breaking news brief, the House Un-American Activities Committee will be reconvening next week. The committee will be investigating un-American activities, such as the murder of children in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the restricting of personal freedoms through the so-called Patriot Act, as well as the infiltration of American organizations by members of clandestine Homeland Security terror groups. Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Central Intelligence Agency? Appearing next week before the committee will be Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Matt Lauer, Katie Couric, Diane Sawyer, Brian Williams, and Wolf Blitzer. And for what reason we have no idea, we would also like to shout out to those men and women serving in 10,000 countries and municipalities, islands, peninsulas, knolls, glens, gullies, inlets, deltas, fjords, and firths, overseas, serving in Berlin and Aachen and Baden and Pfaffen and Lummen and Dürdorf und Donden und Dasher und Prancer und Donder and Blitzen. We need you. For what reason, we have no idea, but thank you for all you do, and we are pleased to send you 50% of our tax dollars. For what reason, we have no idea, but because you are there and they thank you at ball games and on beer commercials, we thank you for all you do. For what reason, we have no idea.
And we're so proud to be sponsored this week by the Minutemen, guarding America's borders from poor people. Our own great-grandparents were poor, and they came here from other places, huddled masses yearning to be free. We were fighting for freedom from poor people, taking aim at frightened lassies crouching by a tree. We urinate on the Statue of Liberty. We defecate on Ellis Island. We've got ours crunched tight in our cold, dead, clammy hands. In just 60 seconds, we're able to desecrate the whole idea of America. We are the Minutemen.
And now you might be a terrorist. With our radio actors Gracie Allen, Bud Abbott, the Andrews sisters, Cliff Arquette, George Goble, Gene Autry, Jim Backus, Lucille Ball, and Ethelyn Lionel Barrymore. Sponsored by Potter Mill Democrat Gonads. Heavens, they're pasty. If you are a good American, then with all the poking and probing, you might well be asking yourself, am I a terrorist? Well, the Center for American Studies has put together a handy brochure, now available in most U.S. interstate rest areas, called Mommy, Am I a Terrorist? If you are driving past a policeman in the United States, you might be a terrorist.
If your Reader's Digest subscription is expired, you might be a terrorist.
If you order a salad, you might be a terrorist. If you are walking down the street, you might be a terrorist.
If your American flag on your front porch, flapping in the good old American seals and crocs summer breeze, is not larger than a circus tent, you might be a terrorist.
If you are directing by remote control from the portico off the Rose Garden while smoking a cigarette surreptitiously in your pajamas, a drone airplane that hits the home of a family in a small town in Pakistan and rips their arms and legs from their bodies, their heads from their shoulders, and forever destroys the lives of their extended family, you might be a terrorist. Chuck, would you like to tell us about the upcoming interview we have with Ole Domegaard?
Well, sure. We mentioned, or one of our readers mentioned the Bilderberg Conference. Ole went to Copenhagen, and he was there outside the Bilderberg Conference, and he has a pretty amazing story to tell about it, and that's what he's going to be sharing with us tonight, and we're going to get to that right after the station break here.
Sounds great, Chuck. I know Ole has been, he's been working at this stuff for 30 years to uncover all the conspiracies, and we're just lucky to have him as part of our show, and we're looking forward to that interview in the next half hour. And now, as promised, we have Chuck's interview with Ole Damgaard. Ole is in Spain at this time, talking to Chuck about his trip to Copenhagen this past week to protest and observe the Bilderberg meeting.
I'm Ole Damgaard. My website is lightonconspiracies.com, and I'm just back from the so-called Bilderberg meeting in Copenhagen, Denmark. Normally these meetings are very, very secretive. The location and the members and the agenda is super secret normally. But this time it had leaked out months ahead where they were supposed to be, and that was the Marriott Hotel in central Copenhagen. Anyway, I flew in from Spain to Denmark, and I came the evening before the meeting was supposed to start. And I asked the people who picked me up if we could please go straight to the hotel just so I could check out the location, see what was going on, the security, whatever security measurements they were doing, and so on, just to get a feeling for the whole thing, also where the limos would come in and out and so on. And when I got to the site, I got very, very surprised because contrary to the way it normally is when this group flies in, they have the top security normally, like they're in their days ahead, securing all parameters, checking exits, entries, making sure that absolute no one can get near to the hotel and so on. This time, absolute zero security. There was only two Danish police officers standing there. I mean, it looked like it was almost like they weren't even on duty. And at the time I came, they were starting to put up like a concrete fence that was pulled around the hotel. And right in front of the entrance were three polished Mercedes limos, the ones that they always used to come to these meetings with. But this was the day before, and there was no people. It was totally deserted. So I thought I found that very, very odd. Because, I mean, I could walk all the way up to the hotel. There were some reporters from the InfoWars, and we were the only people there, more or less. And it did not make sense at all. So, like I said, I've been looking into false flag operations, terror acts, so-called terror acts, assassinations for about 30 years. So I know that this group is super intelligent, and that they use the experts on the highest level to do whatever they want to carry out. So I thought, how on earth could they choose such a strange place? Because this hotel is placed right in the center of Copenhagen, right by one of the main streets where traffic is going up and down all the time. And it's surrounded by high buildings, all of them with windows towards the hotel. The hotel itself has a lot of, the whole hotel is made like a glass, so you can see into many of the corridors and so on. And also on the back side of the hotel is open water, so you've got like this big channel, and then on the other side you've got the rest of Copenhagen, meaning that it's an absolute nightmare to secure, because if you would look at it from a terrorist point of view, if you were afraid of that type of thing, anyone could be with a missile or bazooka or whatever in more or less any building in Copenhagen and still see this one. So it just did not make any sense at all. So I thought, I got this eerie feeling because I thought there's something very, very wrong. So I started looking upon it as from a different point of view. And I found that in my humble way of seeing the whole thing, I thought there were two options. One, this hotel is being used as a decoy to gather the whole truth movement or the protesters in front of the hotel in a fenced-in area so that we could easily be controlled. They could then meet up in another place, you know, one of these big mansions or castles or whatever they normally meet, or another five-star top security hotel, but so that they can control us and be left alone. But when I look at the whole scenario, it gave me an even more eerie feeling, because comparing this to other false flag operations, this setup was perfect for a way to demonize the truth movement. So, because when I looked around, all the buildings around were owned by members of the elite. There was insurance companies, bank companies, and also the headquarters of the Copenhagen police was right in front. And then in between the police headquarters and the Marriott Hotel, there was a big open space normally used as a parking area, like a gravel road, a gravel area. And if you see point from the point of, if they would want to carry out a false flag operation, why on earth would they do a thing like that? It could be a way of knocking out the whole truth movement globally in one go, if they could cause a massacre there that could be blamed on the truth movement. So I started looking upon it like that. And if you place like a film crew down the street with a wide angle, lens. You've got helicopter surveillance with aerial photo. You've got also camera coverage from the other buildings that you control, since they're owned by the members of the elite. You could get a very good picture of a film, you know, from different angles. So what you needed would be, I mean, they always use this problem, reaction, solution. They secretly create a problem to get a reaction from the public, and the reaction they want to is an emotional, oh my God, something needs to be done. And then they, who secretly created the problem, can move in with the solution. And every single time that solution is, they would seal up more and more of your civil rights, your human rights, and just censuring more and more with more militarized police and so on, and surveillance and so on. So when I looked around there, I thought, if they could get the truth movement in there, let's say 2,000-3,000 people in front of the hotel, and the hotel would be more or less empty, there would be a few doubles or something like that, very easy to make someone look like Queen Beatrix with that hairdo, or you know, Henry Kissinger. From, you only have a few seconds from when they leave the limo until they're into the building, so very easy to get doubles to do that job. So you get the whole truth and same thing controlled by police that I'm not aware of, the normal police are absolutely not aware of what's going to happen. And then what you do is you send in some provocateurs. It's enough for just a handful, like 5, 6, 8, 10 or something like that. They always look more or less the same with hoods but most of the time the footwear gives them away. They have police boots or things like that. But anyway, they go into the crowd and they suddenly start shouting really foul language, you know, whatever, the New World Order, blah, 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 the New World Order, start throwing things, these type of things, start shouting at the police. And then also people dressed like police, I'm not saying that it would be real police officers, but with police uniforms, they would arrest somebody innocent. That person could also be part of the whole scenario, or they would just take somebody. And they would drag that person in front of the tent, in front of the whole crowd, getting the whole crowd going wild, saying, oh my God, let him go, let him go. So you stir up the energy like that. You stir it up. Because what they need is drama. They need, when you film this whole thing, they need action, you know. It's not enough to have 13 people sitting smoking a pipe in a corner. That wouldn't do it. You need a whole crowd going wild. So you stir it up like that. And also before that, you place out secondary bombs, smoke bombs and so on in the area. These bombs are often concealed in the machine you pay the parking in, or they can just be boxes or you know, whatever discrete thing that has been placed out beforehand. So once that whole thing is going, you get the whole crowd going, and whoa, 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 action, boom, you blow the whole front of the hotel up, just like they did in Oklahoma City, just like they did in Oslo with the government building. The whole front of the building is just blown up. And since it's an open space, it will be blown straight out on top of the troop movement, not causing a lot of damage to the other buildings that are owned by themselves. So the whole thing will go on top of the troop movement, which will be perfect. Also, people will be killed. There will be bloody corpses. A lot of this thing that would generate more action. And then at the same time, when you blow out that thing, you've got the smoke bombs to go off. So you get this whole thing going. And then some people would be killed inside the hotel. It would be, maybe they have a couple of old Bilderbergs that they can get rid of anyway. Maybe they're annoying them just to get credibility. So they would blow a few of them up. And then the rest of them will be drivers, security people, people working in the kitchen or cleaners or something, just to get a number of names to give it more weight as a credibility. And then they would pump out the media saying, oh my God, this whole truth moment, here they say they're peace seekers, and look what they've done. They massacred this whole poor, innocent little elite group that just had a private meeting and a coffee, you know. And then demonize the whole truth movement, pumping these images out in media globally, saying, my God, we need to stop this. We need to ban all rights of demonstration. We need to ban all rights to protest. We need to censor the internet, because this is the tool of the truth movement. That is how they spread the information and so on. So in one go, they could just knock the whole thing out. So when I saw that, I just thought, oh my God, maybe I'm paranoid here, but I mean, what can I do? So I went home and I phoned up Chip Tatum. Chip Tatum is a former CIA operative, deep cover, 25-year agent he's been an assassin in the Pegasus team, right under the control of George Bush Sr., and also one of the Iran-Contras pilots and so on. Not an amateur. He himself has been taking part in false flag operations. I described the scenario. He said, there's something very weird going on here. He said, just, you know, to cover the water thing, that area on that side, you need several vessels, you know, with uniform personnel. You would need divers in the water. You know, he said that it's so badly picked for security, but perfect for foresight. So he said, watch out for weird sounds. I don't know what he meant with that, but, you know, just watch out. The whole thing could be very much staged for a thing like this. So what I did that night was I contacted, I don't know how many radio stations internationally, I just informed them. I asked the radio host, can you please just record the date and the time when this is released, so that if something happens, God forbid, if something happens, then this will show that it will not be the truth movement, but that it will be an inside job trying to just pull this whole thing and blame, demonize the truth movement. And also my hope was that instead, my intention was absolutely not to spread fear or paranoia, but to make, possibly defuse that plan. If that was what was supposed to be, to go down, then by exposing it, it would neutralize them. So I pumped it out there, and the very next morning, very few people arrived, and I think, I'm very sorry, I think I might be very guilty to that. At the same time, I'm very happy, because it's only by a big crowd that they can pull a thing like that off. And when I came to the place, you know, where the truth movement was supposed to be, same thing, somebody had put a massive big pentagram. I mean, we're talking like 6 meters made of train sleepers, you know, massive, right in that. Can you imagine that aerial photo with a blown up building, smoke, dead bodies, and then a pentagram right in the middle of the whole truth movement?
Ah.
Can you imagine what that would look like and the impact it would have, you know? So thank God, absolutely nothing happened. I just want to say also, the first day I saw very few limos come, and I saw people get out, did not recognize any of them. And these people were even walking around inside the hotel, coming up to the window, standing more or less waving down to the crowd and so on, did not recognize anyone. And then, if it was late afternoon or maybe on the second day, suddenly, you know, it started to make sense. Suddenly you had NATO troops in the water. There were marine vessels, there were army helicopters going around, snipers on the sea roofs. You know, the whole protection was suddenly there, and that's when people started seeing these people like Kissinger, Beatrix, these type of people said, no, they're in there. Because before that, when there was this big question mark, where are they? You know, there was a rumor going that they were at a castle called Kokkedal, just outside Copenhagen, that was where they were actually meeting. But then...
Well, we thank Ole Jamigar for reporting an eyewitness account of what happened outside the Bilderberg meetings in Copenhagen. Later he mentioned to me, and I think it's important, that the Danish police, who have been vilified in some of the press accounts, were actually very good, and he felt that they handled the whole situation very well, and he thinks that's a false claim being pointed in their direction. Okay, on to you, Mike.
Well, it's been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown at the end of the empire. The local newspaper editor is already fighting the rumor of the proposed construction of a new prison near town. His father was also a newspaper man and a Democrat. He despises the term embedded, and he thinks Tom Brokaw, Ben Bradley, Bob Woodward, Wolf Blitzer, Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, probably Walter Cronkite as well, were all CIA. It begins in the heart. Was one of this editor's most recent editorials about the need for a new American Revolution. He had said that if there were to be a revolution in America, it would come from the center, from the heart, the land, the heartland. It would be something to turn the thousands of church buildings into more than social halls, and it would happen here. Because here, some folks have it within them to know right from wrong. Otherwise, what was he doing here? You can't go about your delightful day letting other people scrounge in the dirt for scraps from your table and then act all excited and surprised when they try to snatch a sliver of pie from your kitchen window. That's what he said. He hopes his writing will perhaps get him out of Mount Liberty. Somehow an editor in Sioux Falls or Worthington or Fremont will find him and invite him to a real newsroom. Maybe that boss would let him do his job, the job of any good newspaper reporter confronted with small-town hysteria over some stupid thing. He would face it down with his Macintosh, like a sheriff in the street telling the lynch mob, "That'll be far enough, boys." He recalled something his father told him, well, long ago, I guess. Jackson Cornwall II said to his son, maybe on a warm June day with despair choking the air like too much pollen.
As I recall, in the summer of 1968, Robert Kennedy came to Mount Liberty. He was going to speak at the railroad station that these days is a flower platter or native prairie grassland display, I think. I remember going down there myself on my bike. I was just out of the eighth grade. I wanted to go to pick a saying out of his talk to live by. I sat, stood on my banana seat, listened, and watched him stand at a podium and gesture with his thumb inside his first finger. And I heard that paraphrased Shaw quote that I thought at the time was a Kennedy original. But I see things as they never were and say, why not? Sounds like a plan for someone who wants to try writing novels, I suppose. At the time, I was a pretty mediocre paper. We lived through John Kennedy's murder and Martin and Bobby, barely. Most of us still breathe. I remember the night I went to sleep while we weren't sure yet if RFK was dead. My mother said that for him to recover was what this country needs. Well, we didn't get it. Through my adult life, I've breathed through a number of presidential elections and watched the Democrats get creamed with such sorry candidates. It was all a person could do to drag himself down the church basement steps to vote. And then run home to gargle with Listerine. Can you imagine what life might have been like with another term of John Kennedy, two of Bobby, and two more of Ted? It would have been unrecognizable sitting next to what we have now. I didn't go to Vietnam only because the buzzer went off before I got into the game. I only registered for the draft late due to chronic laziness and apathy. His father ran for office, and Jackson III thought about it. Jackson's dad said he was a Democrat because he remembered asking his mom and dad what they were when Kennedy went against Nixon. He said he would have been proud to be a Democrat standing next to Robert Kennedy, but standing next to the big shots of the Nebraska Democratic Party on the platform at the state convention in Burwell made him want to be somewhere else. These folks did not dare mention war, military, prisons, immigration. Weak, not inspiring, and to this day they continue playing the same game. In his recent editorial column, Jackson III, our current editor, used a little more of this family history. Back then, Dad told me once, we believed Oswald did it. We believed in the Warren Commission, Johnny Carson, the Catholic Church, and the Omaha World Herald, because we were brought up to believe. Go Big Red! We believed in the network TV news anchor. And anything on radio news was true, of course. This isn't Russia. Now we have the internet. We don't believe in any of that stuff. We know they killed Wellstone, the whole 9/11 thing themselves. Actually stole elections. But still, we drift toward fascism as if on a rubber raft on a lazy Sunday afternoon on the Niobrara River, not having the energy to really care about anything, or even lift up our head to see where we're heading. Just toss the empties into the water and stare up at the sky. And leave it all to people in Congress who are either cowards or too rich to care, or both. We go to sleep at night without hope. Bobby Kennedy died. If any children, my own perhaps, are trying to get in close and hear what I'm going to say, grab something to live by, they might hear, what time's the game on tonight? There's going to be enough beer? But damn it, there's still some time left on the clock. When we die, we'll be dead for a long time. We're not dead yet. Kids, here's what I think. We should change the national anthem from that firecracker farce we now have to "This Land Is Your Land," and sing all the verses. We shouldn't stand up like tired robots every damn time somebody plays the other one. And I know you give it all you've got, but you can easily end up giving your 110% for a tyrant, and that just ruins everything. Like those young people now serving in the military for George W. Bush or Barack Obama. We shouldn't pay taxes for bombs or prisons. We should let any Mexicans who want to come here come on in. It's being a Christian nation and all. Any bishops or priests or ministers who say war and bombs and whatever are A-OK should be sent out to get a construction job. Phony bastards. And the Democratic Party, oh, God, the Democratic Party should say a prayer and light a candle and do penance. Look over those pictures of the folks lining the tracks when they brought Bobby Kennedy's body home. Stand for something. Care about something, feel something. Imagine healthcare and poor children fed, and bomb factories bulldozed, and prison walls torn down, and say, why not? There are some Democrats around here that, well, I watch them and I remember my dad. They give me hope. All around here for miles, there are handmade signs and boards rented from U-Haul to dot the landscape. Are you a slave to alcohol? If your Bible is in good shape, you probably aren't. God bless America. We support our troops. But there are also pockets of cynical populists that inhabit the back country. And if I never get to the big paper, maybe they'll save me, pull my spirit out of the blue haze of the television glow into the light. These, they don't put messages on their lawns. They send joke suggestions to Garrison Keillor, review new fiction for the New Yorker. Their great-grandfathers loved Eugene Debs and Robert LaFont, learned to despise the fascist thugs of Woodrow Wilson. Their great-grandmothers admired Dorothy Day and Jeanette Rankin. And they learned at their knees about a day when life was hands-on. People read and cared about what was happening. Followed the deeds of national leaders as if they were sitting at the weekly sales bar at auction or reading the minutes of the local school board meeting or co-op association. They go to church meetings and school plays, realizing they enter and exit always slightly out of step with their neighbors. At election time, they enter the middle school gym with seed corn caps in hand, write in their wildest hopes, and then go home to milk, leaving the radio on into the night. They mow their lawns, scoop their walks, looking up every now and again at the sound of the city snowplow, scraping, listening for the revolution.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We're proud to be here.